Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now we have the privilege to talk again with Dr. Gary Habermas, a world-leading authority on the subject of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Dr. Habermas is a distinguished research professor. He's the chair of the Department of Philosophy at Liberty Baptist Theological Seminary. And Dr. Habermas, welcome back to the program. And I've got to ask you this at the very outset. How many books have you written or co-written specifically on the subject of the resurrection of Jesus?
Okay. Well, it's about 50%. I think the number is 40 books, and I think I have 21 of those are on the resurrection.
21 books on the resurrection, and you've been studying this for years. And I understand you had a period of doubt for about 10 years, but ultimately it was the historical validity of the resurrection that convinced you to be Christian.
Well, I'd already grown up in a Christian home, but I was going through severe doubts after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I did think I was actually wandering into another religion. In fact, later I was kind of taken aback by how close I had gotten to that line, at least what seemed to be the line. But yes, I went through, I usually number it as a period of 10 straight years of doubting, and then another 10 years more intermittent.
Wow.
Off and on.
Wow.
But it was a lot of doubt, and yeah, right to your specific question, friends came to my aid, and I hadn't studied much in apologetics in those days, and they were saying, hey, you should check this out, or you should check that out, or have you seen the scientific data for creation, or hey, archaeology is a good field, or what about the reliability of the New Testament, or the miracles in the Bible, or something like that. And there were even some current, phenomena. I mean, it was real early on that the Shroud of Turin was mentioned to me, and I remember studying one of the early books on the Shroud. And that really piqued my interest because, of course, it was connected with the resurrection. But one day I was just reading the book, and one author said, if Jesus was raised from the dead, it bears the authenticity, it bears the burden of showing that the Christian message is true. And I thought to myself, my first conclusion was, yeah, I can see how that would do it if it's true. And bingo, that started my study.
Huh. When you say it, were you referring in that specific context to the Shroud of Turin? Or were you talking about the resurrection in general?
The resurrection in general. The Shroud was like a little helper in the study of the resurrection. But I've seen many times since, as intriguing as the Shroud may be, and I think it's a fair pointer that needs to be a part of the puzzle. I think the historical for the evidence for the resurrection is far better.
All right, now we jump forward to where we are today, and you have promoted the idea that if we look at the consensus of scholars, even those who are liberal, they don't believe Jesus is the divine Son of God who rose from the dead, etc., but we can call out from everybody, liberal and conservative, minimal facts that virtually everybody agrees with about Jesus, we can actually make a case for the resurrection of Christ. The first of these is that Jesus died by crucifixion at the hands of the Romans. Also,
right,
another fact would be that he was buried in a tomb, probably a private one. Another would be that the disciples were heartbroken and afraid because of his death. The tomb of Jesus was soon empty. What is the significance about these first five facts in this minimalist facts approach? Minimal a facts approach.
Well, Jerry, I know this is confusing, and I need to do something about this in my publishing, but I have two lists of data. And the first one I simply call the accepted facts, and it's a longer list of about 12 facts. And they're ones that don't quite meet the strictures of the shorter list, but they're still quite strong.
Well, I wasn't finished with the list.
I'm sorry?
I was not finished with the list, and so maybe the seven more are what you have in mind when you say that.
Right, right. Yeah, the first list is about 12. Sometimes I do 10. Sometimes I do 14. The reason the number varies is because nobody allows only that number. So I've shaved down the list. Hmm. And so sometimes, depending on what audience, you know, the number moves. But all the ones you just mentioned are from the larger list called the accepted facts, with the exception of the crucifixion. I start my minimal facts list with that one. And one more thing, the crucifixion obviously is not evidence for the resurrection, but I put it in the list because it is a prerequisite for the resurrection.
Sure.
So with that little caveat, the ones you're citing go for this accepted list. But there's still this larger accepted list is still a very well accredited list of contemporary scholars. It would meet almost all the conditions of the minimal facts argument.
I remember one thing Paul Meyer said. He's a professor of ancient history and a very dedicated believer. He said, on the one hand, you know, an historian can't necessarily, you know, assess or agree that, let's say, Jesus rose from the dead. But when you talk about the tomb was empty on that first Easter Sunday morning, that is something an historian can get at. And he says when you look at the evidence, it actually turns out to be the case, and we can learn that even from hostile sources. That hostile
Correct.
Sources, I think, is an important point in this whole argument, isn't it?
Right, it is. It's odd that Paul would do that.
Paul Meyer or Paul the Apostle?
Paul Meyer.
Oh, okay.
And I don't mean odd in the sense of doing something wrong. He's doing something right on. But this list of reasons, facts are allowed for certain reasons. And the enemy attestation that you mentioned is a rule that historians use. And
yes.
New Testament scholars have picked it up from historians. I remember doing an article years ago where I mentioned these, you know, something's too embarrassing not to be true, something's enemy attested, and that wouldn't happen if it weren't true, and so on. But when I did the article, I documented each one of the rules being used by historians, and then I would go over to the New Testament. So these are just normal historical rules for ascertaining facts, and they're not the only reasons, but these rules we're looking for, they are the reasons, they are some of the reasons that the minimal facts are the minimal facts.
Sure. All right, now continuing with the minimal facts, I'm going to just read through the rest of these. The disciples claim they saw Jesus risen from the dead. Because of their insistence they saw him risen from the dead, they totally changed in disposition from being very afraid to being bold and unstoppable. They were even persecuted for their proclamation. They proclaimed Jesus risen from the dead, and this proclamation was there at the very beginning of the Christian movement. It was not some later add-on. They began their proclamation of Jesus risen from the dead in Jerusalem. Their gospel message was simple. Christ died for sinners and rose from the dead. These strict Sabbatarians worshiped the risen Jesus on Sunday, since he arose on Sunday. One of the earliest converts to the Christian movement was James, the brother of Jesus, former skeptic. Saul of Tarsus, the anti-Christian persecutor of the church, claimed also to see the risen Jesus, and then he went on to become the Apostle Paul, one of Christianity's greatest advocates in all of history. So those are the rest of the remaining minimal facts. Did we leave anything out, or do you want to add anything to these points?
No, the list you just gave is the longer accepted facts list, although most of the second one that you just did, part two, is the minimal facts. Of the 12-ish that you just mentioned, I would demarcate a half dozen of them, 50%, you know, approximately 50% of them, depending on how many numbers I'm using, how many facts. I usually use about a half dozen minimal facts, and I would use, of the ones we just mentioned, that would be the larger accepted facts list. I would take away from that all of which you mentioned, but I would use the crucifixion, the fact that the disciples had experiences that they believed were appearances of the risen Jesus. Three would be that their lives were totally changed. They proclaimed not just any message, but they proclaimed the resurrection message in the face of the persecution that you mentioned. And a number of them died for their faith, but nothing stands on my proving that for all 12 of them. I just say that they were totally transformed and willing to die for their faith. James and Paul, two skeptics who came to the Lord, and the fact it came to the Lord because they believed they saw the risen Jesus. And number six, the earliness of the proclamation. I think you said right after the crucifixion. That's exactly right, that this proclamation has been there from the earliest days. You know, Jerry, I did this list. I published this list probably as far back as 1980. What would that be, 35-ish years ago?
Yes.
And I actually did a similar list in my doctoral dissertation 4 years earlier in 1976, my dissertation that I did at Michigan State. I developed this minimal facts argument just briefly there. And the number changes because, like I said, sometimes I want to emphasize one of them or another one, but they're just a number of the group. They're a number of the larger context. And what the minimal facts requires, I have two rules. The first one is by far the most important. It is not what critics often say it is. Habermas is quoting authorities, and he thinks he can establish facts because people say so. That's just so far from being the most important criterion. The most important criterion is that I will use no bit of data which is not attested from several directions. In other words, I have several strong, themselves accepted, reasons to accept each of these facts. Secondly, and this is a lesser reason, but secondly, because that evidence is so good, that's why the vast majority of critical scholars get on board with these minimal facts and allow them. I would say the six I just gave, I would say we're in the 90-something percentile of skeptics. And I kind of keep a loose head count of what I, of who concedes those things. So that's the two criteria. I don't use a fact which is not multiply evidenced. And secondly, because the evidence is so good, that's why the critics get involved. And so lately, Jerry, one of my sentences that's been kind of rocking people's boats lately, the skeptics, it's in all my material, but lately I've been kind of hanging it out there to give it more exposure. The point I'm making is, even on an unreliable New Testament, now Christians don't believe the New Testament's unreliable, but skeptics do. And even on the skeptics' unreliable Bible, the resurrection happened. In other words, skeptics, the first thing they go to, I mean, usually, not always, but the first thing skeptics go to is, don't you know there's some problems in the resurrection accounts? And among the first things to be brought out are things like this. We don't even know all the women's names who went to the tomb. We don't know how many angels were there. Of course, there's always one or two, so the story's pretty close. But we don't know how many angels were there. And was it this or was it that? Was it this or was it? And they think that by using problem passages, they can throw the whole thing out. It doesn't work like that. That's not how we do any, a police report on a right. car accident, two journalists reporting on a football game,
yep.
Anybody, a historian who's deciding what happened at the Spanish Armada in 1588. I mean, you can study any of these things, and there are going to be different stories. Now, I'm not saying the accounts in the Gospels are different. I'm just taking the critics' view.
Yep.
And I'm saying even if they were to show an unreliable New Testament, which is their goal, here's the problem. An unreliable New Testament still gives a resurrection. So if the New Testament's inspired, bingo, Jesus' veneration of the dead. But if the skeptic's Bible's correct, don't keep piling on examples and saying, here's another problem. Even on a New Testament with problems, the resurrection happened. Why? Because don't tell me about the things you don't like in the accounts. Tell me about the things you agree with me on. And if I can get the resurrection out of those, then the British really beat the Spanish at the Armada. So-and-so really won the football game. such and such a car really was at fault during the accident. That's how we put all these things together. You're not going to disprove the resurrection by saying, were one or two angels present at the tomb. Give me a break.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a little rule. If we can talk like this every day, don't blame the disciples for talking that way. If I say I'm talking to Jerry Newcomb right now, somebody can't come along fairly and say, you liar, you talk to the thousands of people who saw listened to his station in the interview at the exact same time. I'd say, excuse me, did you get up on the wrong side of the bed? You know, that's the proper response, not I said I was talking to Jerry when I was talking to many others. It's just, you know, that's just not fair. But my point is, my single point in a single sentence is that the minimal facts, if used even alone, satisfies the believer's inspired New Testament, the unbeliever's unreliable New Testament, and both sides should allow that there's still a resurrection because we agree on the basic facts. That's enough to show the event happened.
Right. All right. GaryHabermas.com for more information. I'm reminded of the old creed, still cited in many churches today. Christ has died. Christ is risen. Christ will come again. Thanks so much for being with us, Dr. Habermas.
Jerry, I enjoyed it. Thanks.
God bless you now. All right. Bye-bye.